Welcome to NucleCast, the official podcast of the NY Deterrence Center. Our host is Dr. Adam Laufer, co-founder and vice president for research at the National Institute for Deterrence Studies. The NY Deterrence Center is a 501c3 organization ensuring a broader understanding of the nation's strategic nuclear deterrence and its ongoing modernization. Thank you for listening and welcome to the show. The views of the host and the guests are their own.
Welcome back to another great episode of NucleCast. Of course, I am your host, Adam Lowther, and today we're going to have a guest unlike any other. I'm talking about Michael Casey. So if you don't know Michael Casey, he spent a portion of his career at DIA, where he worked on Chinese C4ISR issues, and now, you know, he's left DIA, and he writes at Orders and Observations. It's his Substack, and if you've never gone there, check it out. He's got a lot of really interesting articles on, you know, Chinese C4ISR and sort of their technological development. And so for you in the nuclear enterprise, if you want to know how are they going to command and control forces and what capabilities are they developing, this is sort of a one-stop shop for that kind of information. So Mike, welcome to NucleCast.
Thanks, Adam. It's a real pleasure to be here. I'm a longtime listener and really appreciate the work you do.
Yeah, thanks. So you're really the first person that we've had on the show that is, you know, sort of an expert in these issues. And, you know, we oftentimes have talked about China's, you know, nuclear breakout. But a key component of, you know, this is sort of like Sevi Wilson once said, you know, NC3 is the fourth leg of the triad. And that's not just true for the United States. It's true for the Chinese and the Russians as well. And so, you know, the reason I wanted you to come on the podcast was who better to talk to about these kinds of issues and where the Chinese are and sort of what they're developing than you. So with that in mind, sort of give the listeners a sense of what the Chinese are up to in terms of modernizing their command and control, their space and cyber assets and capabilities. Are they a peer of the United States? Are we ahead of them? Are they ahead of us? Sort of where are we in these kind of core technologies and capabilities?
Sure, and I would characterize the Chinese military as a near peer or a peer of the United States in several components with respect to their C4ISR architecture. So I think just from the 30,000 foot view, the story is the PLA is undergoing a pretty fundamental change. And so for the past 20 years, the headline has been about China building new ships, new planes, and new missiles. And it's a story of the incredible modernization of its hardware. But the story today and going forward, and the one I think is the most critical for us to understand, is about how they're wiring all of that hardware together into a single intelligent and integrated combat system. So broadly, they're moving from a military of platforms to a military of networks, and really trying to posture themselves for the next generation of warfare, going from what they characterize as informatized warfare, so warfare characterized by the integration of network systems and space sensors, to what they call intelligentized warfare. So warfare characterized by the integration of AI, big data, and autonomous systems at all levels of warfare. So, you know, for much of the PLA's history, it was playing catch up. It was trying to model itself off of the United States, particularly after viewing U.S. precision operations during the Gulf War. And now going forward, it's really kind of going out on its own and developing its own doctrine and operational concepts for an era of warfare characterized by AI.
So for their nuclear command and control, I had some conversations in Beijing and elsewhere. It was probably 10 years ago, about nuclear command and control and conventional command and control and the sort of integration of those two for the Chinese. Now, in the years since, have they fundamentally sort of modernized their command and control networks? You said we had this informatization and intel, you know, it was all part of this systems warfare that I don't know for our listeners if they followed sort of this discussion about systems warfare that the Chinese have developed, but they've developed a very sort of advanced concept of how they want to wage war and how they want to defeat the United States in particular early in a conflict. But in terms of how they actually command and control nuclear weapons, do they have all of sort of the core capabilities, the space assets, the integrated tactical warning and attack assessment, you know, all of the communications requirements? Do they have all of that capability that we in the, you know, in the U.S. would kind of consider a modern NC3 architecture?
So I would describe it as still a work in progress. The Defense Department in its 2024 China Military Power Report stated that China would likely, I believe, adopt a launch on warning posture by the end of this decade. So I think the major hurdle to that is on the NC3 side. And so building out the specific nuclear command and control procedures and networks, establishing higher readiness levels and the safety protocols inherent with that, or trying to square that with the Chinese Communist Party's intense focus on control over China's nuclear arsenal. So a lot of that is still being built out, but we see kind of the nascent components of it. For example, on the early warning side, we see the launch of a series of early warning satellites similar to the U.S. SBIRS system. We see the construction of large phased array radars on the Chinese mainland, and all that being integrated with the broader C4ISR architecture. I think the areas that are still probably being worked out on are particularly on nuclear C2, so trying to square away the authorities either within the Central Military Commission Joint Operations Command Center, so China's highest command organ, and trying to differentiate between, you know, conventional and nuclear responsibilities. And then are they building out a separate NC3 network or going to use existing networks? And that commingling has been, you know, a part of China's C4ISR architecture for decades now. And it kind of remains to be seen the extent to which that commingling will continue to go forward. And then I'll also add, I expect there's probably some issues with particularly the C leg of the nuclear triad, and just ensuring that, you know, Jin SSBNs with mated nuclear warheads on board conducting at sea deterrence patrols kind of have the communications infrastructure and command and control procedures to actually have those nuclear weapons to be able to launch them to the satisfaction, again, of that kind of intense focus of control that the CCP has over its nuclear arsenal. So not quite there yet, but I expect within the next few years, we'll be able to describe it as a relatively modern NC3 system.
So help me better understand it. So is it that they have all of the systems, the technical capabilities, but it's weaving them together and sort of figuring out how that those processes are going to work? Is that where they're, you know, they've got the technical systems, now it's the processes? Or is it more than that, or something
different? I think that's largely a fair statement. They've got the sensors, they have the existing networks. It's about having the procedures in place that such that the Chinese high command is confident at having warheads at, or its nuclear forces at, a fairly high state of readiness, something that they were not comfortable with for the vast majority of the history of the People's Republic of China, where, for example, the force was at a very low state of readiness and, you know, live warheads were not mated. And so it took them a while to transition to that wartime posture. So I think it's one, a question of process, and two, a question of just confidence on behalf of the likes of Xi Jinping that the force is ready to do this without some sort of accidental launch or detonation or what have you. But I think the fundamental infrastructure and hardware is largely in place.
So the, for the Russians, you know, as we know, they had would, for example, have, you know, their launch control officers would be senior colonels instead of, for us, you know, junior lieutenants. They would have, you know, multiple steps and verification before a launch. So there was a sort of a lack of the similar trust that we might have in our officers and processes. Do you see that? Is this, as I understand what you're saying, is this sort of the challenge for the Chinese that, like, you know, in their system, in a, you know, an authoritarian system, is it this fundamental problem with trusting, you know, your personnel up and down the chain that they will perform their duties, perform them as ordered, without sort of attempting to act in opposition to, you know, Xi's orders? Is that sort of the question, or is it just a question of can they fundamentally execute because of competence?
I think it's both. You know, as an example, the early warning architecture is within the aerospace force, the newly elevated aerospace force as part of last year's reforms to the strategic support force is all relatively new. So yes, you might have the early warning satellites, but do you have the data fusion and early warning procedures for dealing with things like false alarms or what have you in place? And that's something that personally I don't think they've quite worked out yet, or at least that, you know, they haven't worked out to the level of saying where we're officially willing to stand the system up and declare, you know, a launch on warning posture. And that's separate, I think, from the political confidence in, you know, the cadres that are actually within these organizations. I think if you look at the reforms that were that you know to the C4ISR system last year, so for folks who don't know, last year in April, the Strategic Support Force was disbanded, and the SSF was created back in 2015 to bring together China's cyberspace and electronic warfare assets. And so now 10 years later, they disbanded it. You know, it's not really clear why. It appears like there were some problems with the ability to integrate these disparate forces across the PLA, or perhaps binning them into one organization just proved to not be inefficient and it added another layer of bureaucracy. But these are the same entities that would be responsible for that early warning mission. And so it looked like they said, okay, well, we want to stand up at the aerospace force separately to refine capabilities and proficiencies and responsibilities just like that early warning mission. So I think we can look to the reforms last year as at least one piece of evidence to say they're not quite there yet.
Yeah, it's an interesting question for those, you know, who are familiar with the Chinese nuclear arsenal. I mean, these were, you know, for much of their history, they were, warheads and missiles were demated. They were, you know, they were never going to be essentially first strike weapons. They were, you know, postured to ride out a first strike and then be used in retaliation. So as you, Michael, are talking about, the idea of moving to launch on warning, that is a huge change and step that requires sort of a technological sophistication in your NC3, particularly your advanced warning and your, you know, your ability to see and know what you're looking at, that it's hard to sort of get people to be able to appreciate just how much of a change that truly is from their past posture, which was, you know, we'll have them, they're perhaps, you know, in caves, and once we dig them out, we open the tunnels, we'll mate them, we'll then posture them to shoot, and then we'll respond later. That's a fundamentally different nuclear force than what you're describing and what you're saying, you know, they're sort of moving toward, which is, you know, akin to what we have. And it's
doing so across different components of the nuclear triad. So the PLA's The air leg of the triad is also completely new. The sea leg of the triad, for the most part was, submarines with unmated, missiles going around. And so just the triad itself is all very immature and new. And then you add on the changes to just the command and control side. And so in that, minimal deterrence, assured retaliation posture, the decision to retaliate was a collective leadership decision by the Central Military Commission and likely parts of the Politburo Standing Committee. You can't really have that very deliberative, longer process if you're in a launch on warning posture. And so the intent is to kind of move to a posture where the chairman of the Central Military Commission, Xi Jinping, has sole launch authority. And so then we're trying to build out, okay, what is the C3 infrastructure required to do that? Do you have kind of an equivalent to the president's, football briefcase to enable retaliatory orders to go down through the force from Xi Jinping? And so just it's a complete wholesale revamping of the nuclear C4ISR architecture to make this happen.
Yeah, absolutely. That's a fabulous point. Well, we're now at that point where we have to take a quick break, so we'll do that. And when we come back, I want you to give us a sense of why you think they're, engaged in this dramatic expansion, why you think they're fundamentally shifting their nuclear posture. So give us that when we get back. You're listening to NucleCast, and we'll be right back.
This episode of NucleCast is brought to you by the AMLA Deterrence Center, whose mission is to educate Americans about the nuclear enterprise and strategic deterrence.
And we're back. We're talking to Michael Casey. Michael's spent a lot of his career at the DIA and was a C4ISR analyst. Michael, I posited a question to you before the break. And so what is your take on this, just fundamental change for the Chinese in their nuclear enterprise?
So I think the change is driven by a couple of key factors. First is Beijing's evolving view of the strategic landscape, particularly vis-a-vis the United States. And so the United States is modernizing its own nuclear arsenal. We're talking through improvements to our ballistic missile defenses. And then we continue to build out conventional strike capabilities that the Chinese leadership views as, perhaps being or having the effects of a potential nuclear first strike. So they're very concerned, I think probably overly concerned, with the effects of U.S. cyber or space capabilities against Chinese C4ISR nodes and critical infrastructure. So it's both looking at the broader, U.S.-China relationship, and then just the expansion and improvement of U.S. strategic capabilities. Then you can also look at, China's local neighborhood of the growth of nuclear and long-range strike capabilities with countries such as India, and then most importantly, the necessity for a nuclear deterrent, or at least Beijing's view that needs that sort of nuclear deterrent in a Taiwan scenario. So they Chinese leadership and Chinese strategic thinkers, one of the lessons they took away from the Russia's invasion of Ukraine was that Russian nuclear deterrent prevented a larger NATO intervention in Ukraine, and that they think they can have the same sort of strategic deterrent effect in any sort of conflict over Taiwan. And prevent the United States from getting more involved in some sort of conventional fight. So, one, it's the broader relationship. Two, it's the evolution of U.S. strategic capabilities. And three, it's kind of lessons learned from looking at foreign wars, particularly in Ukraine.
Yeah, that's a good point. We've been thinking for the last several years, what are the lessons that China will learn from Ukraine, and the idea that they will learn that Russia successfully deterred NATO from intervening in a more substantive way, and therefore nuclear weapons and nuclear threats can do that for them when it comes to Taiwan, is, you know, it's sort of a, it's almost like a no brainer that that might be sort of the lesson that they learn from it. But do you see China having aspirations? They've sort of created this narrative when it comes to, you know, it was Hong Kong and now, you know, sort of Taiwan, that Taiwan has always been this core part of China, and that, you know, it's a breakaway province and all of, you know, it's got to be returned. I mean, it's not historically accurate, but it's the narrative that China tells itself and most Chinese citizens believe. But do you think that, so they want Taiwan, but do you think that there's more that they want? Are they going to want, for example, you know, to establish sort of a hierarchical international order that they were used to, you know, in, you know, for 1500, 2000 years, in which, you know, there was a tributary status for South, or for Korea, for, you know, Southeast Asian nations, for others? Or are they, you know, are they going to want, do they want to just stay regionally and just sort of be, hey, we want to be the most respected in our region? Is it bigger than that? What is it that you might say that here's what China's looking to accomplish?
It's a big contentious question. And my view is that China undoubtedly wants dominance within the Asia Pacific. And globally, it wants to be respected as a leader across different domains and to structure a global international system that's broadly deferential to Chinese power. And so that involves inserting itself and increasing its authorities in different international institutions, to undermining U.S. power in different regions of the world. Does it look to compete with us across all domains in all geographies, you know, like perhaps like a threat like the Soviet Union? No. It still sees the international system built by the United States as broadly beneficial to it, but its intent globally is to restructure the international system so that it is, again, broadly beneficial and deferential to Chinese interests while maintaining dominance within the Asia Pacific region specifically. So I err on the side of seeing Beijing having pretty high global ambitions and not just being content with dominating its backyard. You know, Chinese leaders talk about having a world-class military. That doesn't, to me, just mean, hey, we want to be as good as the United States. It's no, we want to be the best. We want to execute what they call leapfrog development in new technologies and new domains like space and water and undersea warfare, and, you know, outmatch the United States. And that is, to them, both within the realm of the possibility and as they're increasingly confident in their capabilities, but it's a strategic imperative if they want to be able to dominate the Asia Pacific and be able to restructure the world order according to their interests.
And do you think that there is, you know, from your analysis, do you see China succeeding? Do you see fundamental internal challenges? How do you think this, you know, this sort of aspirational effort that is clearly underway, right? China is executing it. They're moving out. You know, Xi's fundamentally changed the political structure in China, and they're building the capabilities. They're doing what it takes to make this happen. Do you see a problem, or do you see a point where failure could be likely, or where the whole effort can fall apart?
That's hard to say, just because coverage of China vacillates between extremely dire and that the Chinese are going to take over the world and just a lot of discussion on the flaws in the Chinese system. So we'll hear one day how they are leading in AI and robotics and in other advanced manufacturing. And then the next day, their property sector is completely underwater and the economy will slow down and their birth rate's declining. So broadly, I see the China continuing to develop world-class capabilities in specific sectors like AI and robotics, and you kind of application of AI across different industries, batteries, for example, while continuing to struggle in other parts of the economy. And the big question is, how do they navigate this going forward? So in terms of, military capability, I think it's a story of the extent to which the PLA can, execute its war plans quickly, and how much it, what type of effect these kind of new deterrent capabilities it brings to bear are. As an example, the PLA seems to be extremely confident in its cyber capabilities, one, to have a strategic effect, and two, its ability to integrate cyber fires into multi-domain joint operations. Whether that will actually work, we don't really know. I'm a little bit pessimistic, but one can imagine that, if you're going all in on having some sort of a cyber effect that you've never actually executed before, then maybe it doesn't work. So it also, assumes a lot about U.S. Willingness to intervene in a Taiwan conflict, that some sort of, the PLA researchers discuss or mention executing a cyber Pearl Harbor against the United States. And I always found that confusing because Pearl Harbor didn't work very well for the Japanese. And why is that your choice of analogy? But it's a serious threat and the most important pacing challenge that the U.S. Defense Department has ever had. I see it as much more challenging longer term, just in terms of the sustainability of the threat and the capabilities that the People's Liberation Army can bring to bear than, say, the threat we faced during the Cold War against the Soviet Union.
Yeah, I mean, more, size matters, much bigger nation, much bigger economy. You've got a lot of smart, there's more engineers that graduate from Chinese universities every year than we have in total. They have so many advantages. I wonder, and I'll pose this to you before we switch to Bob the Genie, but I wonder, is there a cultural dynamic in an authoritarian regime that is fundamentally oppressive that harms the ability of all those tens of millions of engineers? And of course, general, historical Chinese culture. Is there something about it that just makes it hard for it to be as innovative and as independent and as sort of, dynamic as it needs to be to surpass the United States and ultimately defeat us?
So again, it's a difficult question. And let's take AI as an example, or at least China's strategy of military-civil fusion. So just like the United States, China is attempting to increasingly leverage its commercial sector for military capabilities. That's given it the ability to draw on the innovation of its commercial sector to purchase things like commercial off-the-shelf capabilities in areas like drones, as an example. But by and large, the state-owned enterprises still largely dominate the Chinese defense industry. Or even in space, as another example, in the space sector, it's the SOEs that are largely dominating. And it's very difficult for commercial Chinese space companies to get access to that capital. Whereas in the United States, it's been much easier for those same company, commercial companies to access capital and to expand into commercially viable businesses. They're not competing with SOEs that have unlimited subsidies, as an example. So those types of dynamics can, I can see being problematic. And the second is like just the cutthroat nature of China's commercial industry in areas like AI and robotics, that, the profit margins are razor thin. They continue to rely on state subsidies. And you have to wonder that at one point, does this kind of capitalism with Chinese characteristics run out of steam? It's all predicated on the capacity of the state to absorb losses. So there's just another area where, particularly if debt becomes an issue going forward, that model maybe doesn't work as well as it once did. Whether or not there are cultural issues with translating commercial innovation into military capabilities, it seems right now that it's not evident that that's a problem. But we can imagine that some of the structural issues in this system can become increasingly large obstacles going forward, at least compared to what we're seeing in the United States.
Yeah, good points. Good points. Thanks for that. Okay, so we now are at that point where we want to bring out Bob the Genie. So as I rub my magic lamp, Bob the Genie, of course, grants 3 wishes to all guests, so long as we don't wish for wealth, fame, fortune, that kind of stuff. So with that in mind, Mike, what is your first wish?
Okay, so my first wish for Bob the Genie is that we avoid World War III with China. You know, when we talk here, you know, we're talking about fairly large-scale conflict with a nuclear power, you know, the likes of which we haven't seen ever. And so, you know, it's interesting for me as a China analyst or you as a nuclear analyst to talk through these issues, but we're really talking about, particularly when we game out Taiwan scenarios, of, you know, an unprecedented war between nuclear states, major conflict over Taiwan, tens of thousands, if not more, people dead. And so my first wish is it doesn't come to that. We can maintain dialogue, and some of the deterrence capabilities that the United States is working on that you have championed do their job and prevent, you know, major power conflict. The second is that a lot of my work involves artificial intelligence. You talked about the integration of these capabilities into NC3 systems. There are differing debates in the United States and China between human on the loop and human out of the loop for these different systems. And so my second wish is that we don't fall into some unintended escalation spiral and crises due to the increased integration of these systems into both conventional and nuclear capabilities. What one can imagine, you know, when we're talking about China moving to this launch on warning posture, it's got this very nascent, immature early warning system. It's trying to integrate AI into that. It's just a situation replete with potential, you know, crises, or, you know, officers not understanding the outputs of their AI systems and misinterpreting something as a missile launch. So my hope, or my second wish, is that as AI is, you know, is increasingly integrated into militaries around the world, that some of the more doom and gloom scenarios don't come to bear. And my third wish, and I wish I should have thought about this a little bit more. you know, I have lots of wishes, whether that's the LA Lakers do well next season in basketball or what have you. But I do hope, you know, just selfishly, that more work and funding and maybe interest by junior analysts is given to C4ISR issues in particular. I remember as an analyst at BIA, a C4ISR, you know, C4ISR analysts were kind of shunted into the corner. Folks across the Pentagon wanted briefings on the latest Chinese aircraft carrier or missile system. And to me, you know, the future warfare will be decided in the information domain. It'll be decided by whichever side can achieve what the Chinese describe as decision dominance. Who can execute their OODA loop faster? And I think that requires more analysis, more analytic resources to these areas, whether that's looking at broader strategy, operational concepts, whether that's bringing more engineering talent to bear to look at these issues. My third wish is that, just, you know, as an analytic enterprise, whether that's in the intelligence community or elsewhere, that folks just pay more attention to C4ISR issues as kind of the nervous system that makes modern militaries work, and that enables these future operational concepts like JADC2, as an example, in the U.S. military.
Yeah, well said. Those are all 3 good wishes. I think I would share them all. So I'll give Bob an extra nudge to make sure those come to fruition. So with that, unfortunately, we're out of time. So, Michael Casey, thanks for joining us on this episode of NucleCast.
Thanks, Adam. Really appreciate it.
And thanks to you, the listeners, and we'll see you next time. Well, great discussion. I always enjoy the topic. It's a passion of mine. So glad that Mike and I could have that discussion. And just a reminder, check out his Substack, Orders and Observations. If you Google Orders and Observations, you know, it'll pop right up. He's got a lot of great articles there. So that was a great discussion, sort of great to hear sort of where the Chinese are heading and what they're capable of. Hopefully you enjoyed it.
This has been a production of the Anhwa Deterrent Center, a 501c3 that seeks to educate key decision makers, stakeholders, and the public to ensure a broader understanding of the nation's strategic nuclear deterrent. Our executive producer is Kimberly Charrington, and this episode has been engineered and mixed by David Krumpel. Help us grow our followers by sharing it and follow the show on LinkedIn, Facebook, and Twitter at NucleCast.